Thanks, David. It's indeed a great pleasure to be here and to be one of the co-organizers of the workshop on quantum phase transitions. And I hope I will be able to convince you today that quantum photography and quantum sound actually also have some relationship to quantum phase transitions. Now, since we physicists are always looking for new funding mechanisms and new funding niches, I'm planning to create a quantum rock band. So if you're interested, your applications will be taken after the talk. So what is quantum photography and quantum sound all about? Well, we know from our classical lives that if we want to create optical images or if we want to make music, we need waves. We need light waves to create optical images, or we need density fluctuations, density wave, to create sound. Now, we know from quantum mechanics that there's something called the particle wave dualism that tells us that particles have wave-like properties. And so, as a condensed matter theorist or scientist, I might wonder, can we actually transfer the notion of creating of images or creation of sound to condensed matter systems? And how would we actually do this? And until about, I would say, 5, 6, 7 years ago, the answer to that question with regards to condensed matter physics was no. It's really very difficult to transfer these notions that we know from our classical lives of creating images into the condensed matter world. However, at about 6, 7 years ago, there were some major progress in the creation of what we now call artificial atomic structures, or quantum corrals. And these nanostructures that I will be talking about can actually be used to create images or the equivalent of sound. Now, these type of nanostructures give rise, or these type of quantum corrals give actually rise to an abundance of very interesting physical properties, that you can create images. One finds selection rules for the creation of images. One can tune the manipulation, or one can manipulate the interaction between quantum objects. One can destroy quantum objects. And last but not least, one can also create local quantum phase transitions. This is the motivation and or the introduction. I will start and I will leave off the roadmap here with some motivation and some experimental, very beautiful experimental results that came out a couple of years ago concerning these quantum clouds and the creation of images. In the second part of my talk, I will then talk about some work that we have done in my group in Chicago on quantum clouds in superconductors, and in particular the creation of what I call quantum candles, the relationship to quantum chiral geometries, triangles, ellipses, squares, whatever. I will talk about quantum copying, and you see this is in quotation marks, because we all know that you cannot really quantum copy a state, but there is some resemblance to this that one can actually create a quantum chiral. And last but not least, I want to make a relation or a connection to our workshop and talking about quantum phase transitions. And let me also encourage you to stop me at any point. I know that this is a very diverse crowd of scientists here, many with non-condensed matter backgrounds, so please feel free to stop me at any moment if you have any questions. So let me start with the experimental motivation. Now, if I want to create an image, we all know I need to have a quantum object whose image I can actually create. So the question is, how can I actually create quantum candles, quantum objects in condensed matter systems? And if I create a quantum object, which I will call the quantum candle, whose image I want to create, how can I actually detect the quantum object, the quantum candle, and its images? Now, the answer to the first question, namely how to create a quantum candle, was answered in a very beautiful experiment that came out of John Eigler's group together with Harry Manhara at IBM Almaden. And what they used was a feature that occurs when you have what we call a quantum effect in condensed matter systems. So since it is important to understand how you can actually create this quantum candle, let me give you a short tutorial about what the quantum effect actually is and how one can create a distinct signature that then one can use as a quantum candle to create a quantum image of this. So let's assume, so this is going to be a short tutorial on the quantum effect and the creation of a quantum candle.
There?
Yes?
So you've told us what the quantum candle is that you're going to.
I'm going to, I didn't tell you that yet. So the first thing to do, of course, if I want to create an image, is to create a candle. And how you actually do this in condensed matter systems is a thing that I will talk about now. And the way you do this is by exploiting actually the quantum effect. So let's assume I take a condensed matter system, let's say I take some bulk copper system or copper surface now. And I put a magnetic impurity, which means an atom that might not, which is not necessarily, or in general, is different from copper that has a magnetic moment, such as gadolinium or nickel. So this atom that I put now on the surface of this copper surface is, or this copper block can be gadolinium or it can be nickel. So it has a spin and it can interact with the conducting electrons or the electrons in this piece of copper by an interaction that I'll discuss later. Now, why do I take copper? Why do I take a metal? Because it's important that if you actually look at the density of states of such a system as a function of frequency, that the density of states is more or less flat. And of course, if I just have a flat background, then there's nothing distinctive that I can actually use to make an image of. So we have to create some perturbation in the system, and this is what we're going to do with this nickel or gadolinium atom and the quantum effect to get either a spike into the density of states or to get a suppression in the density of states, but some distinct signature that we can then use to create an image of. So I have my nickel or gadolinium atom that interacts with the conduction electrons of the copper surface. Now this interaction is just an exchange interaction. So we have a J, we have the spin of the impurity that interacts with the spin of the conduction electrons. Now in order to create actually a quantum effect, we need that this J is actually positive, or we need that we have an antiferromagnetic coupling between the impurity spin and the spin of the electrons. So what this means is that the electrons scatter off this impurity, and the scattering is described by this, what we call an exchange term, Heisenberg's exchange term. Now, why is this important? What is actually the physics? So the electrons scatter off the impurity, and of course, if I write this interaction term like this, then there are also spin flip terms involved. So the electron, if we just think now in terms of spin 1/2, if the electron comes along, it's scattered off the impurity, and there's a spin flip. And that, of course, happens quite often because there are many electrons in such a metallic system, and because of these spin flips, the effective spin of the impurity is actually screened if we go to temperatures which are low enough. And this screening of the magnetic impurity, of the spin of the impurity, is what we call the Condor effect. Now, how do we visualize this? Well, if we have the magnetic impurity sitting somewhere, this is now the spin of the magnetic impurity, then we can visualize this kind of screening effect as coming about from a what we call a Condor cloud. So we have the electrons, the spins of the itinerant electrons, which form a screening cloud around the impurity such that this entire object here has a spin which is equal to zero. And if this happens, the effective magnetic moment of the impurity is completely screened. Now, this screening of the magnetic moment of the spin of the impurity occurs below a characteristic temperature, which we call the Condor temperature. Now we can calculate the Condor temperature just to give you an idea of what the relevant energy scales are that are involved in such a problem. And one finds that there is a relationship between the density of states of such a system, the interaction strength, and the bandwidth of my condensed matter system, in this case, my piece of copper. It turns out that the Condor temperature is given by the bandwidth of the system times e to the minus 1 over the magnitude of j times n f, where n f is the magnitude of the density of states at the Fermi energy. So if this here is the Fermi energy, then n f is the value of the density of states at the Fermi energy. So this gives us an idea of what the energy scales are that are involved. A prefactor, which is the bandwidth, and we have the effective exchange coupling J, and we have the density of states of the host system of the copper system here. So what happens now if I go to lower temperatures? Well, above the Condor temperature, one can consider this magnetic object here to basically be free. There is no screening. Below the Condor temperature, much below the Condor temperature, this object is completely screened. Now it turns out that the screening of the magnetic moment is accompanied by a change in the density of states of the copper system. And that is the famous Condor resonance. Namely, take some other color, we find that there is a dip in the density of states. So this is the density of states of our host system, so in this case it is copper, and we find that as we go to temperatures much below the Condor temperature, there's a dip in the density of states at some energy, let's call this ES, and now we have that this depression of the density of states occurs in the immediate vicinity of the impurity. So now we have our quantum candle. We have a distinct signature in the density of states, namely a dip, which is locally or spatially localized in the vicinity of the magnetic impurity. Okay? This is how you create your quantum candle. Now I should also say that the width actually of this dip is proportional to the Condor temperature. So this is the first step. So we created now a quantum candle. How do we actually measure this quantum candle? Yes.
My question is, why do you call this a candle? That's what I
want. A candle?
Yes.
Well, what I teach undergraduate physics, and I teach optical geometry or geometrical optics, I usually use an arrow, right? But that's pretty, you know, war related. So I use sometimes also a candle. And then I make an image of that with my lens. And that's why I call this a quantum candle. It's a quantum object whose image you want to create.
It's not a source of light or anything. It is something that you want to look at.
Exactly. I mean, you can actually use the analogy of a source of light as a source that emits electronic waves that are refocused, and we'll come back to that in a second. So from that point of view, it's there is some analogy to a candle in the sense that it is a source of waves in condensed matter system of electronic waves or matter waves. So how do we actually measure the density of states? Now we have created a quantum candle, but we still need to measure actually the density of states. Well, one technique that has been used and extensively developed over the last 10 years is scanning tunneling microscopy or scanning tunneling spectroscopy. So let me just tell you in a few words how you actually measure, and this would be the question, second question, how to measure. Density of states. So what happens in this kind of experiment is that you have your bulk system. So this could be now the surface of my copper system. I have my impurity sitting somewhere on the surface of the system. And now in scanning tunneling spectroscopy, one uses a tip, which in general is a conductor, and one applies a voltage difference between the tip and the sample, and one measures the current that flows from the tip into the sample, and depending on whether V is positive or negative, of course, I can either have electrons flowing from the tip into the sample or from the sample into the tip, and when electrons flow from the sample into the tip, it's the same as if holes flow from the tip into the sample. So I measure the current, I fix the voltage, and if I take the derivative, dI dV, then one can show that this is proportional to the density of states at a given location, so it's a function of R, and it's a function of the voltage difference times the electron charge, and we just take this as the frequency. And this, of course, sounds, if it's described by a theorist, pretty trivial, but it's actually not. This requires to do very good and high resolution experiments like the one that were done by John Eichler, really requires a lot of finesse. And only over the last 5 to 10 years has been a lot of progress been made that allowed high precision measurements, that allowed actually to see what I will show in a couple of minutes. So this is how you measure the density of states. You use scanning tunneling. Tunneling. The cost. Now let's come to the actual experiment that was done by Hermann Ahern and John Eigler, and how they actually now combined the quantum candle that I described here with the measurement of the density of state. So they came up with an ingenious idea. They used an analogy to the classical work, to the classical world, for this creation of a quantum image of this quantum effect quantum candle. So how did they do this? They took a system like copper, this is now the surface of copper, and they put an array of impurities on top of that in the form of an ellipse. And these impurities that they used were cobalt atoms. And they put them into the geometry of an ellipse. And the number of cobalt atoms that they actually put on top of this copper surface varied from 50 to about 100. Now cobalt, as I said earlier, is actually a magnetic, or possesses a magnetic moment when it's put in copper. So all of these cobalt atoms here actually undergo a quantum effect. Now the interesting thing is that one can now put an additional cobalt atom with a spin into the focus of this ellipse. And we know that the focus is a very special point when we talk about an ellipse. And why that is, we'll come back to that in a second. So there's a cobalt atom in the ellipse. They cool down the system. They measure the density of state. They found that there's a quantum resonance at this point. Let's call this focus number A. So they measured the density of state. This here is the Fermi energy. versus the density of states. And they indeed found that there is a dip near the Fermi energy, which is the condensation. And that was measured in focus A. Then they redid the experiment near the second focus, near focus B. But there was nothing in this focus. The focus was just empty. So there's no additional cobalt atom actually in this focus. They did a measurement of the density of state, and what they found was that there is an image of this quantum resonance in focus B. It is weaker than the original candle in focus A, but nevertheless, it is there. And if you take now this cobalt atom, basically this what is called a quantum coil away, and you redo the measurement in this point, there is nothing. It's just a flat density of state. So that was the proof, if you want, that one can actually use this artificial atomic structure, this quantum coil, to focus, now we come back to Shankar's question, to focus the electronic waves that are emitted by the quantum resonance here into the empty focus B. From that point of view, it's actually a quantum candle. Now, how can we actually understand this? Well, it turns out that understanding this is about 200 years old in the classical world. Imagine that you just this is a classical explanation, and then we come to the quantum mechanical explanation. Let's assume you take an ellipse.
And how far apart are those cobalts?
Pardon me?
How far apart are they?
These are about 10 angstroms apart. And so the size varies, of course, but this is about 300 angstroms. Let's assume you take an ellipse, and this is a mirror. And now you put, indeed, a candle into one of the foci. Now, what will happen? If this here, if the wall of this ellipse is a mirror, then the rays are specularly reflected, and we know that they all are reflected, and this is the property of an ellipse, they are all reflected into the second focus if this candle is in the first one. So no matter where the rays go to and how they are, as long as they are specularly reflected, they will be reflected into the empty focus. And now you can say, well, this is kind of the classical picture. Here, the quantum resonance, as a quantum candle, was also in the focus. So yeah, maybe semi-classically we can understand why there is actually now an image of this quantum candle in the empty focus because of this analogy to the classical case. And this classical case was actually first looked at in the beginning of the 19th century, 1825. There's a famous book by Weber and Weber, it's called Wellenlehre in German, where they actually looked at exactly this problem. And they did something slightly different. They actually took a container, an elliptical container that was filled with mercury, and they dripped mercury in one of the foci, and they saw an image of this dripping mercury in the empty focus. And so the classical analog of this experiment is basically 200 years old. That is a classical explanation. What is actually the quantum mechanical explanation? In order to understand the quantum mechanical interpretation, we have to go back and think in terms of eigenmodes or eigenfunctions of this coil. Now, what do I actually mean by this? So this is a quantum mechanical explanation. Let's consider that this is really a tight wall, that the scattering potential along this wall is not finite but infinitely large. Then I basically, quantum mechanically, can look at this problem as an infinitely deep potential well. So outside here, the scattering potential is infinitely high. And then I know if I put a particle in this box, there are various eigenstates that this particle can go into. So if I plot now the wave function squared, then there's a ground state, there's a first excited state, this is now the wave function squared, and so on and so on. Now, if I had really a very strong scattering potential along the wall. Because of this analogy to the particle in the box, I would create eigenstates, fermionic eigenstates inside this quantum corrupt. Now, what was shown after this experiment is that one indeed needs to use, quantum mechanically, these type of eigenstates, also called eigenmodes, in order to understand the creation of a quantum image. Now, simply speaking, if I have, for example, a quantum object at this location and I can excite this type of eigenstate, then because this is an eigenstate that penetrates the entire structure, I need to have a maximum in the wave function at this point, even if I only excite the state here. And this excitation of eigenmodes is the reason, the quantum mechanical reason, why one can actually create and see this quantum image in point B. Now, of course, this is not the eigenmodes that we need to use here, of course, not eigenstates, because this is not an infinitely high potential barrier, so the electrons from inside the corral can actually leave the corral. So there's, these are, if you want, only resonance states.
So it sounds like the cobalt atoms around actually would be better off such they're not magnetic. You only need the potential, but you don't need the state.
Yeah. And I mean, in the paper that was published by Igra's group, the data that are shown are ones where you have cobalt atoms also along the wall. But the statement in the paper is that you can also use other potential scatterers along the wall.
So in order that's to, what they get?
The statement is that if they do this, if they replace them, then you get exactly the same picture, or the same effect.
Okay.
Yes?
So the actual condos problem near point A is a complicated many-body problem.
Yes.
But in the end, you're explaining in terms of single particle wave functions in an ellipse. So I guess the complexity of that state is not that important, except to be a source of wave.
Exactly. I mean, after this experiment, there were actually quite a number of theoretical studies on this. And actually, Gregory Keaton, who is a postdoc here, and Eric Heller were among the first to actually look at this problem. And they basically reduced it exactly to what you just said, namely, there is some signature here, the quantum candle, the quantum resonance, and they modeled the entire wall just by potential scatterers. And that was completely sufficient in order to explain that there is or that you can create a quantum image here. There's actually, this by itself has actually raised a lot of questions because it's not quite clear at the moment what, for example, happens to the condo resonances along the wall. One would expect to find also a lot of condo resonances and hybridization between the condo resonances. But that has not been observed. And that was then the justification for just saying, well, let's consider this to be potential scatterers. And then you get a good explanation of the experiment. Now let me, just before I...
Dirk, can I just ask, again, you've used the Kondo impurity for at your focus, but couldn't you use an ordinary impurity and use the Fresnel oscillations and focus them?
If you just need... so you're saying if I just take a non-magnetic impurity here, you can do this, but the Fresnel oscillations are, in general, they don't really give you a dip in the density of state that is really pronounced. I mean, usually because, usually what you find if you plot this as a function of frequency, and also, as a function of space, you get oscillations. But as a function of frequency, you see that there's not one particular frequency where you see a dip, but it's really a very broad maximum. So in this sharp dip here, it becomes very shallow, and then it's very difficult to actually say whether you see really a quantum image of that in the focus. Yes,
but the physics is exactly the same, right? Even if you take three dimensions.
The physics is exactly the same. I mean, so from that point of view, theoretically you can do this, but experimentally you probably wouldn't see it because you also have damping in the system. Yeah, and so let me just say that the eigenmodes, the oscillations of the eigenmodes that were actually observed experimentally look actually like this, where you have larger density of states in this eigenmode in the foci, and you get what I now plot here is basically an intensity plot. So apart from this wall, this means that the intensity of the density of state at this given point is large. So if you want, what I basically plot is now the square of the wave function corresponding to this eigenmode. And these were the eigenmodes that were, well, this was one of the eigenmodes that was actually observed in the experiment. And I apologize for, I never got a very good grade in art in school, so I apologize if that is not a very good rendering. But the interesting thing is that you actually see something here along the wall, which we all know very well if you go into St. Paul's in England. Then these are basically the whispery gallery modes along the walls of the corral, and even those they could see in the experiment. Yes, please.
So I do not understand the following thing. If these waves are scattered by cobalt, why don't they go in the bulk?
Oh, they also do. So these waves are actually damped. So you see, you can actually measure the damping of a lifetime of these waves, and you see that they go into the bulk. But the hybridization between the surface states and the bulk states is weak enough such that you can still talk about these eigenmodes as halfway reasonable eigenstates. So their lifetime is long enough to actually create these type of quantum images. So if the hybridization is too strong, you will wash out everything completely. Okay, so half of the talk, more than half of the talk is over, and I just gave you the introduction, so I have to speed up a little bit. But these experiments, or this experiment actually, and many experiments that followed afterwards, have basically created a new way to use local physics to play around with quantum mechanics. I mean, we are very familiar with the ingredients, eigenstates and infinitely deep potential bulk, the creation of eigenmodes. And this was the first experiment that used these eigenmodes and the creation of these eigenmodes to do something that we couldn't do before, namely create a quantum image. So now the question is, can we actually do more with these systems? What happens if we don't take just a simple metal, but if we take systems, whole systems, that actually possess complex electronic correlations? Can we create more and interesting new physics? And it actually turns out that indeed we can do this by looking at various geometries of these corrals by using different host systems. And the one combination of geometry and host systems that I'd like to discuss are actually quantum corrals in superconductors, and in particular in S-wave superconductors. Now, why do I do this? Because there's a lot of interesting new physics. There will be new quantum candles, new features to the density of states that one can use in order to create quantum images. One can show that one can use these systems to tune and manipulate the interaction between quantum objects, such as spins, which might or might not be interesting for development of quantum computation. We find selection rules for quantum imaging, and we can also drive the system by using a quantum curl through a local quantum phase transition. Now, let me give you, since I'm going to consider quantum curls on the surface of superconductors, let me just give you a very short introduction or tutorial or refresher, if you want, into some of the essential ingredients of superconductivity. Now, we all know that superconductivity is a rather old phenomenon. It was discovered in 1911 by Kamerling Ohms in Leiden. And how did he discover it? He measured the resistivity of mercury as a function of temperature, and at about 4.2 Kelvin, he found that the resistivity drops rather sharply, and with an experimental resolution at this time, the resistivity dropped to zero. And now we know that indeed the resistivity in these materials below a characteristic temperature, which we call the critical temperature, indeed drops down to zero. And this was in 1911. It took quite some time, maybe until 1957, when the first microscopic theory was proposed, and that was a theory by Dean Cooper and Schrieffer from UIUC called BCS theory, which showed that if there is any attractive interaction between electrons, then this gives rise to the pairing of electrons in what we now call a Cooper pair and the loss of resistivity below a certain critical temperature, Tc. So an attractive interaction gives rise to pairing of electrons into a Cooper pair. And the types of superconductivity that I will consider is the one where the pairing occurs in the singlet channel, so the total spin of the Cooper pair is zero, so I have an electron with spin up, an electron with spin down, with momentum k, and with momentum minus k, and these two electrons up pair into a Cooper pair, spin singlet with zero total momentum. Now, you might wonder, what is the attractive interaction that gives rise to pairing in the first round of superconductors, the so-called low-temperature superconductors like mercury, niobium, niobium, dot selenide? These are just lattice phonons. In high-temperature superconductivity, what gives rise to the attractive interaction? Well, if I want to be safe and not killed by the rest of the participants in this workshop, I should better say something very safe, which is electronic correlations, not phonons. But what the particular form of these electronic correlations is, that is still a topic of debate in this field. Now, superconductivity is kind of funny because the pairing, now if we think in terms of fermionic operators, the pairing actually occurs in, well, the pairing is of particle hole type. Now, what does this mean? If I have operators in the normal state that describe my my material, so I have creation annihilation operator C that creates an electron with momentum K and spin up, and I have another creation operator that creates an electron with momentum K and spin down in my system, and I can describe the Hamiltonian or can write the Hamiltonian second quantization using these operators. Then if I go into the superconducting state and I want to describe fermionic excitations there, then the fermionic excitations are a mixture of electrons that I create and electrons that I destroy. In particular, alpha, let alpha be the new creation operator for describing fermionic excitations in the superconducting state. I can write this as uk, some prefactor, ck up dagger, minus v, minus k, c, minus k down. So the new annihilation operator in the superconducting state is a mixture of a fermionic creation operator and a fermionic annihilation operator. And because of this, now if I use this kind of language, I can diagnose the Hamiltonian. And because of this kind of mixing, we talk about particle hole pairing in the superconducting state. And this particle hole pairing will actually give rise to an interesting effect, as I will discuss in a minute. Now, the new excitation spectrum for the fermions in the superconducting state is given by the following expression. Namely, I take the normal state fermionic excitation spectrum, I square it, I add what we call the superconducting gap, I square this, and I take the square root of this, and this is the excitation spectrum, the fermionic excitation spectrum in the superconducting state. And what this implies is that that there's a gap that opens up in the density of states as I go into the superconducting state. And this opening up of the density of states is a very important feature that I will use in the following. So, again, let me plot the density of states. This is frequency. This is the density of states. Somewhere we have the chemical potential, the Fermi energy. I said earlier that in the normal state, the density is flat. And as I go into the superconducting state, I now open up a gap in the excitation spectrum, which has the following form where, with respect to the chemical potential, this is at energies minus delta, and this is at energies delta. So now there is a forbidden region for fermionic excitations in the superconducting state. Now, why is this actually important? It turns out that one can now use the depletion of the superconducting state, of the density of states in the superconducting state, in order to create new quantum candles, new signatures in the density of states by again using magnetic impurities. Now, I have to, in order to explain this, I have to go back to what we call the Anderson theory, that states that if you have a magnetic impurity, in a superconductor, you actually create what we call bound states inside the superconductor. But if you have a non-magnetic impurity, so there's no spin involved, then one cannot create a fermionic bound state in the vicinity of the impurity. Now, how does this fermionic bound state actually show up? It actually shows up as two peaks inside the superconducting gap. So again, I have a magnetic impurity, I put them in the superconductor, I do my SCM experiment, and what I find are peaks, states, bound states inside the superconducting gap at energies minus omega B and omega B. And this state here is also called a Schieber state. And this state only exists in the vicinity of magnetic impurities, but not in the vicinity of non-magnetic impurities in a superconductor. So again, I can use a magnetic impurity to create a new type of candle. But while for the condo resonance, I only had one dip in the density of states, now actually I have two peaks in the density of state. And that the fact that I have one peak below the Fermi energy and one peak above the Fermi energy, so I have a particle and a hole like state, comes from the fact that in the superconducting state, I have particle hole pairing. Now, the energy of the state of omega B, one can actually relate to the strength of the scattering term. It turns out that omega B divided by the superconducting gap is equal to plus or minus 1 minus the strength of the scattering J times the spin times the density of states in the normal state squared divided by 1 plus J S NF squared. So as you increase J, the scattering strength, you see that the numerator becomes smaller and these peaks move towards zero energy as you increase J. And what happens as you reach zero energy or the Fermi energy is something that I come back to in a second. Now I should say that in these systems, in the SI superconductors, because of the hard gap that we have, there's no condo effect. And these type of Schieber states were actually first observed in 1997 in a beautiful SCM experiment by Ali Yazdani. So, I have new quantum candles in an SI superconductor. Now let me do exactly the same experiment again. The quantum, actually the experiment is, I shouldn't say that, I should say let me do the theory because the experiment has not yet been done. So let me do the theoretical experiment, and let me take an S-wave superconductor. This is the surface of the S-wave superconductor, and let me put now a quantum corral of non-magnetic impurities around it in the form of an ellipse, and in one of the foci, I again put a magnetic impurity. Now, this problem here circumvents some of the problems that we discussed earlier. Namely, these non-magnetic impurities here do not do anything to the SI superconductor. They do not induce any bound states. So in the experiment before, we had the question what actually happens to the condo resonance around the wall the equivalent of the Condor resonances here would be the Schieber states, but we don't have any Schieber states along the wall. These are just potential scatterers. We only have the creation of a Schieber state here in the focus. And what I now find when I calculate the density of states, and I don't want to get in too much now into how we actually did this, we used two different methods, we indeed again find that we get an image in the empty focus. And the two methods that we actually use, and I would be more than glad to discuss that after my talk, is first what we call a generalized scattering theory, what's called as, also known as a T-matrix approach. Which we generalize to deal with scattering in both in symmetry states, like a superconductor, and the second approach was what is known as the Bogoliubov, which then formalism. The first approach is a perturbative approach based on Green's function. The second approach diagonalizes the Hamiltonian immediately in real space. The advantage of the first approach is that one can use or deal with infinitely large systems, but we cannot account for spatial variations of the order parameter, the superconductor order parameter. The advantage of the second approach is that we can actually deal with these spatial variations, but we can only look at finite size systems. So what we find is, again, and maybe I should actually just say this in words, I already done this, that if we use now one of these magnetic impurities in one of the foci, we see that there are two peaks in the density of state. And if we look at the empty focus, we also find that there are images of these two peaks. So the same geometry as in normal state, different quantum candles, we can create in images. Now, this might not be too surprising, that we can actually do this in a superconductor, albeit with a different quantum candle. After we actually found this result, we started to think about why should we be modest and just start with the creation of a simple quantum image? Why don't we go and see whether certain chiral geometries and the eigenmodes related to different chiral geometries allow us to create multiple images at the same time? Now this, in quotation marks, I would call quantum copying, because what we do is we make multiple copies of a single object, but not of a state. So it does not violate the no cloning theory. So what we did is we looked at the eigenmodes of triangles. And why do we actually look at the eigenmodes of triangles? Because there are experiments by an STM group at the Free University in Berlin who just prior to before we started to work on this, looked at nanostructures or artificial atomic structures in the form of triangles. So let's look at the eigenmodes of triangular quantum clocks. Now, it actually turns out that the wave functions for a particle in a triangle has been analytically solved for a long time. We basically just used our method, our approach to see whether we can reproduce the analytical result, and indeed we did. So we use a triangle of equal sides, and put it onto the surface of first a metal to see what kind of eigenmodes we get. And let me just show you the first few eigenmodes that you get as the, so this again, the wall of the quantum chiral. The first eigenmode has a peak or maximum in its intensity in the center. The second eigenmode has three maxima in the corners of this triangle. The third eigenmode has four peaks, one in the center and three in the corners. And the fourth eigenmode in energy has has three strong peaks close to the sides and weaker peaks, weaker maxima in the corners. So these are the first four eigennodes of such a triangular structure. Now, by adjusting the size of these triangular structures, one can actually change the energy with respect to the Fermi energy of the system. So what we did was we used these two, we adjusted the size of these triangular corrals in order to have these two modes close to the Fermi energy. Close to the Fermi energy, versus the Fermi energy means close to these impurity states here. And it turns out that in order to create quantum images, we do not only need that these objects are where the, or that in this case the impurity states are not where only where the maxima in the eigenmodes is, in the wave function, but they also have to be close in energy. So if all of these modes were far away from the Fermi energy, then this state would not be able to actually couple to these eigenmodes. So we have to bring the eigenmodes close to the energy of these states. So we did this by adjusting the size of the length scale of these triangular states such that these two eigenmodes are close to the energy of the Shiva states. And what we then find is that indeed we can create multiple images of the quantum candle. So what in this case what we did was we put again a magnetic impurity in the center of this triangle, and we find that by coupling to this eigenmode, which is allowed because it's close in energy and because of its symmetry, creates images in the corners of this triangle. So this geometry allows us, in contrast to an ellipse, it allows us to create simultaneously more than one, in this case, three images of our quantum candle. And now, of course, one can play this game with various geometries, and one can create an arbitrary number of quantum images. So when we first saw this, we thought, well, why don't we get into the business not of quantum music and a quantum rock band, but quantum copying machines. Well, it turns out that in the quantum world, these quantum copying machines also break. And what is even worse, they eat up the original. So if you don't put the copy, the original, correctly into the copy machine, it disappears. So if I take this quantum object, now this is again the mode, if I take this quantum object, which is my impurity, and I put it here, in a node of this eigenmode, not only do I not create images, but I completely destroy even the fermionic bound state. So instead of having this type of density of states, I just completely destroy my fermionic bound state. So, unfortunately, copying machines in the quantum world do not work better than copying machines in the classical world.
But then you sell it as a shredding machine.
A shredding machine, right. Quantum information. Yes, please.
But am I right that the resolution of your copying machine is very good because it's determined by the shape of the wave function?
Yes.
And so if you put the impurity there, if it would be in isolation, you make a localized state, you cannot reproduce that because you couple to that particular wave function. And then it's only that wave function that is reproduced because
exactly. It's not a copying. I do not copy really an entire state. If you want, I just enhance at other locations basically the wave function.
You just couple to the appropriate eigenmodes.
Yes, exactly. So this is why I put quantum copying here in quotation marks. I mean, obviously, if I were able to actually really quantum copy the state, yeah, I would have been violated. I would have violated a couple of laws in between. But, now, since time is running out, let me actually just very briefly talk about how one can actually use now these systems to drive the system, or drive the whole system, through what's called a local quantum phase transition. Now, I mentioned to you earlier that as I increase J at a certain value for J, namely when J times S times the density of state equals 1, the energy of these Shiba states is actually 0. Now, it turns out that one can characterize these two states according to their spin quantum numbers. Namely, the particle hole state for small j's has spin down character, the other state has spin up character. Now, when you increase j, what happens is that these two states will actually cross, such that I have different color. That as j increases, eventually I will have a peak here, which now has spin up character, and I will have a peak here that has a spin down character. And you might wonder what actually happens to the system. Is there any interesting physics associated with this crossing of these two peaks? And it turns out that there is indeed interesting physics. When I calculate the total spin polarization of the system, so I calculate SZ, which is 1 over 2, the integral over all sides, BDR, the integral over frequencies from minus infinity to 0 of the spectral function for the up electrons minus spectral function for the down electrons. This is the total spin, SZ spin polarization of the system. It turns out that for JS times NF smaller than 1, because this is a singlet superconductor, the spin polarization is 0. But if JS NF is larger than 1, the spin polarization is equal to 1/2. And that was actually first discussed in the 70s by Sakurai. What is the physics behind this? Basically, if the product out of the coupling strength or scattering strength and the density of states becomes too large, it is possible to actually break a Cooper pair, and one of the electrons from the Cooper pair forms a pi bound state with the impurity spin, and the other electron is free to roam around and changes the spin polarization of the system from 0 to 1/2. Now, this looks like a first order phase transition because there is an abrupt jump in the spin polarization. And this is known in the literature as a local quantum phase transition because it changes locally, it changes the spin polarization of the entire system, but it appears locally. Now, it actually turns out that for many impurities, JS times NF, for many systems, this is actually smaller than 1. So it actually, so far, has not been possible to actually look for this quantum phase transition in realistic systems. However, what we found is that by using the quantum Perels, we can actually artificially enhance the density of states at some positions inside the Perel, and we can reduce them at other positions. Now, what this means is that one can actually have a spatially dependent quantum phase transition. So if I take, and we have now done these type of calculations just for a circular Perel, if I put a magnetic impurity in the center of the circular Perel, I'll get the violet case here, namely where the spin-up state is at negative energy, so the spin-down state at positive energy. So this means that I have actually gone through the quantum phase transition. But if I move this impurity one side to the right, so I now move it out of the maximum of an eigenmode. Because the eigenmode that I, of course, play around here is one that has a maximum in the center. So if I move it away from that maximum, then I recover the blue scenario. So the density of states is strongly spatially dependent inside these quantum Perels. And by moving these impurities around, I can basically vary between the cases where J times S times NF is smaller than 1 or where it's larger than 1. So these quantum Perels and the creation of eigenmodes can actually be used to play around with spatially dependent quantum phase transitions. And we first look at this in the context of superconductors, but the same, of course, can now be used for the condo effect. So if I just put the Perel on top of a copper structure, then in general, if the scattering potential is strong enough and I can actually create eigennodes that are sufficiently strong, I should be able to see a conduit effect at certain positions at a given temperature, and if I move the magnetic impurity at other positions, I should not be able to see this conduit effect. And that might be something to further play around with in the future. Well, with this,
yeah, there's one point worth mentioning here.
Yes.
You know, your calculations are based on two-dimensional models.
Yes.
So, I mean, there is, you know, a bulk in the real experiment which sits below these two-dimensional quantum corrals. And so the density of states that appears there, the expression is the density of states of all the electrons, not just the one in the surface. So you never reach perfect node in these quantum corral experiments where the wave function is zero because they're bulk states.
Okay,
below.
You're absolutely right. In the normal state, you're of course absolutely right. However, when I do these calculations in the superconducting state, I of course can pull the quantum, the eigennodes into the superconducting state, and this is what I play around here with. Because it's a hard gap, the lifetime of these eigennodes becomes infinitely large. But of course you're right, particularly when one just looks at normal state materials, one has to worry about these things. And there are very beautiful experiments by Karl-Heinz Rüder's group at the Free University in Berlin who have actually explored this. But they see, for example, even in their structures, which are completely normal state and strongly coupled to the bulk, they still see the creation of eigennodes. So with this, let me just close that. I hope that I've shown you that these nanostructures, these artificial atomic structures, can actually be a new playing ground for quantum photography, and if you allow me, for my final quantum run here. And there's a lot of what we might consider very simple quantum mechanics which can now be tested in these nanostructures, and I think that there's a lot of new and interesting physics that can be and should be explored in the future. And with this, as I said in the beginning, applications for my quantum rock band will be taken now. Thank you very much.
Any more questions?
Well, just a comment. I mean, I would call it particle-particle therapy. Particle-hole therapy,
yeah.
Means particle-hole mixing. But
a mixing, yeah.
It's part. It's preparing the particle-particle channel. Yeah, you're probably right. Particle-hole mixing is probably a bit
sure.
The better expression. Yes.
Yeah, and also Chiba state exists in where superconductors develop magnetic impurities. Just the potential scattering includes the Chiba state.
Right. So the you're of course right. If I have a non-magnetic impurity in a direct superconductor, that already gives me a state. But Chiba states usually are referred to as bound states. So, I mean, I've not seen the use of the name Chiba states for these resonance states in D-wave superconductors, but that's just a terminology.
Yeah, you can also start talking about notations. One phase transition is also a little bit double-sided. It's not thermodynamic phase transition.
Right. No, but it's a phase transition which you change one of the properties, namely the spin polarization of the ground state.
It's not a phase transition.
Why not?
Because there's no phase.
It's a thermodynamic limit. There's no change.
But I can say, you know, I can calculate this quantity, right?
It's critical.
And you change this quantity.
It's critical.
Yeah, I understand what's going on. It's only a question about working.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're right. It's, of course, not a phase transition in the sense of a magnetic phase transition in the body system. But nevertheless, you change one of the ground state properties of the system.
Just a little clarification, the impurity scheme for the superconductor part is actually an Ising scheme, right?
That's a very good point. You can either work with an Ising spin, and then you basically get what I just showed you, or you can also treat a Heisenberg spin, and you average over all orientation of this Heisenberg spin. And then you actually get exactly the same answers to what I just showed you.
You're saying the solution for the Ising spin and the Heisenberg spin are actually identical?
Yes. So if you actually take the, if you, for example, in this generalized key matrix approach, if you actually take the spin direction and you average in Heisenberg spin, you'll all basically all types of orientations, and you average over these orientations, you actually find that you get exactly the same bound state energies as if you just assume that you have a single Ising spin.
That's very surprising because for the Heisenberg spin, you have spin flip process between.
Yeah, it's well known in the literature, so I can just show it to you. Okay. Yeah. It's pretty straightforward.
Okay. You work in the elements, you don't have to tune the energy because in the short wavelength limit, one focal point always focuses on the other focal point. You don't have to worry about energy levels.
No, you actually. No, it actually, if you look at the energy of, so this is my energy axis, and now I want to calculate where actually various eigenstates live in the energy distribution, then I find that there are eigenstates basically even for an ellipse all over the place. Now, what you want, of course, if you have this Condor resonance, is you want to have an eigenmode which is close to this energy. And in order to do this, you actually have to adjust the size. Because what you do is, you might have that this energy here, ES, sits in between two eigenmodes, and then it does not couple to the eigenmodes. If you change the size of this ellipse, you can actually change the position, the relative position of these eigenmodes with respect to ES. Actually, in this, the experiments that on Eigler did, he did not always find that a quantum image could be created. So he actually had to adjust the size or the eccentricity of the corral in order to get it just right that the eigenmode that actually connects these two foci is close to the energy, basically to the energy of the Condor resonance.
I realize now what I was saying wrong. The one of the focal points is definitely a good place to sit because a lot of wave functions are going to be peaked there. But the energy has to be also.
Exactly. So you need the position and you need the energy.
But that's probably because your energy is relatively low. If you would have higher energy, the density of the state becomes higher, so then the likelihood of coupling to one on the appropriate state.
Exactly. But then, but if you do this, we actually look at this, if you have a lot of eigenmodes sitting very close to energy, it's very difficult to actually see an image. Because we have different geometries, different, and I didn't even have the time to talk about this, but you have different symmetries of these eigenmodes. And so what you find is actually not a well-defined quantum image, but...
That's a bit counterintuitive, because then the geometric idea is sort of breaks down.
Exactly.
So what is the physics behind that? Right?
Behind
the geometric picture, because you have simple waves that scatter off your potentials and things like that, or is that because the energy gets so high so that they get absorbed?
No, the problem is if you're in a region where you have many eigenmodes that by a geometry you can actually couple to. So, for example, this is the third most eigenmode that actually has a maximum in the center. But there are other eigenmodes that also have a maximum in the center. So if all of these eigenmodes are sitting close in energy, you might not only get images here, but you can get images here, and then somewhere you have whole regions. So the whole, and you create all of this at the same time. And then you have really a problem with resolution. So as long as your eigenmodes are far away or well separated in energy, you're fine. But if your eigenmodes become too close in energy, this whole concept of quantum energy breaks down.
Intermediate region, because if you go to sufficient high energy, the ray tracing has to work and sort of interfere out. But okay, this is probably.
I think the ellipse is really special because there's a prevalent location in the ellipse suggested by Dr. Dinarpi, which they don't have in the triangle.
Well, the triangle, you can say you have the center, and then you look at the eigenmodes. And here, of course, I mean, the same that you also have to do in the ellipse, you basically have to adjust the size such that one eigenmode has a high density of states in the center is close to the Fermi energy. But the same argument also holds for the ellipse.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.